This morning, we're delving into a subject that makes us squirm. I commend you for being here. Woody Allen said, "I'm not afraid of dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens." We live in a death-denying culture. The idea of thinking about how we would want to die if we have a say in it is foreign to many of us, let alone talking with our loved ones about our wishes. When and how do we start these touchy conversations? As we heard earlier, Ellen Goodman says, it's always too soon to start the conversation until it's too late. I propose that reframing our hesitation into viewing it as giving our loved ones a gift may help us take these first steps. Before, in the meditation, when we were envisioning how we would want our last day to go, I'd like to see a show of hands. How many people wanted to die at home? A little more than half, maybe, most. So the facts speak volumes about this topic. 70% of Americans say that they want to die at home, and 70% of Americans die in hospitals and institutions. 90% of people say that talking with their loved ones about end-of-life care is important, but 27% have actually done so. 80% of people say that if they were terminally ill, they would want to talk with their doctor about end-of-life care, and 7% report having had end-of-life conversations with their doctor. 82% of people say it's important to put their wishes in writing, and 23% have actually done it. Let's explore some ideas about why this happens. By way of background, I've been playing music at the bedside for people at the end of life for nearly 23 years, and I coordinate a palliative care program similar to hospice. Over the years, I've been present for what could be considered good and bad deaths, and I've walked beside families that are trying to advocate for their loved ones in their final days as best they can. I've seen firsthand that when the dying person has clearly expressed their wishes, the healthcare team and the family can do their best to align the care at the end of life with the person's priorities. And when the person's wishes are unknown, it leaves the family to guess and project what they think the person would want. These can be excruciating decisions to have to make for another person. They can tear families apart. That's why I look at it as a gift we give our loved ones to be clear about our wishes for care. When a patient is deemed unable to make their own decisions due to cognitive impairment, a doctor invokes their healthcare proxy. Then the person that they have chosen to speak for them must make the decisions on their behalf. All the healthcare proxy has to go on is their knowledge of the person and whatever information they have discussed with their loved one about their wishes for care. These may have been communicated in broad terms, such as, "I don't want any extreme measures to keep me alive," which is what my parents said to each other. However, if you are in the position of speaking for someone who's unable to call their own shots, this may not be very helpful. Does this mean you don't want to be on life support? Or does it mean you don't want CPR? Or does it mean you don't want an emergency surgery? Or does it mean you don't want antibiotics to treat an infection? Or what? Sometimes interpreting these wishes is left to the family to navigate in unknown medical territory. That's why being as clear as possible in the conversation can help. It's not uncommon for some people to say, "If I ever get..." And then you can fill in the blank here. Cancer, Alzheimer's, not able to care for myself, then just shoot me. Well, great, no pressure or anything, just take me out back, put me out of my suffering. Sure, I'll be glad to do that. This may express a wish, but it's not exactly realistic or something a loved one can carry out. One thing that may be hindering people from talking or even thinking about what their wishes are could be that we can't know what we will face in the future. So it may be worthwhile to spell out our wishes in different possible scenarios. Tools like the five wishes can be a starting point. It's not a legally binding document in Massachusetts, but it can be a guideline for the type of care we would like and provides a place to record our preferences. It is available online. There's a link in the yellow resources insert in your leaflet. I encourage you to fill it out and let your loved ones know where to find it. Also, our wishes for care may change depending on our circumstances, and it will probably be necessary to revisit and amend what we tell our loved ones. This was clear in a post on the Conversation Project website by Marsha, no relation, on September 7th, 2015. She says, "My husband had stage 4 prostate cancer for 5 years. He died from a rarer metastatic secondary cancer he'd battled for 6 months, a cancer that consumed his liver, his mind, and left him a bruised mess full of morphine and speechless as he left us. His last two physical acts were a sigh and a squeeze to my hand. He died in his own bed in his sun-filled room. No death is idyllic. His death was a clock-stopping goodbye at one moment, an accelerated multitasking frenzy the next. But we'd had the conversation, and we had revisited that conversation to edit it, enhance it, and strengthen it. I knew how my husband wanted to die, and I did my damnedest to respect and realize his wishes. When the perfect storm came, we weren't ready, but we were on the same page. And that page was ultimately his to write. Not mine, not our friends, not even his doctor. His engagement with his death and his acceptance of it and of my role as the guardian of his wishes continues to give me strength. There's a hole in my heart, but my husband and I dug that hole together as best we could to fit him. I urge others to have the conversation. Start early, incrementally. Don't be afraid to amend, assess, revisit it. Like all conversations, it's not the product, but the process that's the thing, the listening and replies, the voices of love and fear and inevitability that need to be heard. To digress for a moment to a related topic of handling a person's affairs after they're gone, I want to tell you about Chanel Reynolds and read an excerpt from her website. To preface it, I need to warn you that there will be words spoken that are not usually uttered within these sacred walls. If you can't do that in a Unitarian church, where can you do it? After losing her husband suddenly, she had to navigate getting their affairs in order while grieving and becoming a single parent. Each day, she would wade through the details of life insurance, his unknown phone and computer passwords, the will they drafted but never completed, and she would say to herself daily, "Just get your shit together." This led to her starting the website, getyourshittogether.org. Here are the excerpts from her story. "On July 17, 2009, my husband, Jose Hernando, was hit by a van while riding his bike down a pretty road near the lake a few miles from our house. He was set on going for a quick training ride before his last bike race of the season. I wanted him to go to a dinner party with me and our 5-year-old instead. Our last moment together, he was being goofy and adorable, wanting me to kiss him before he left. I refused twice. He tried one last time, and I couldn't help smile at him and kiss him back. My last words to him were, 'Okay, I'll kiss you, but I'm still mad at you.' 20 minutes later, it was all over. The accident was really, really bad. It disseminated his upper spine and caused an immediate traumatic cardiac arrest. Technically, he died on the scene. But somehow, Jose made it to the hospital with the barest of a pulse. Everyone was shocked. The paramedics were so well-trained, the hospital so close, and the ER docs were so amazing. Jose was in such incredible physical shape, they were able to keep just enough of him alive. And yet, after a time-suspending week in the ER, surgery, the ICU, every possible test told us the same story. He was never coming back. So I made the decision I was most certain he would want. I approved removing medical support, and then quickly he was gone. There I was now, a single mother, grieving, facing one of the worst things that could possibly happen. The trauma and grief are enough to completely level you, and yet the fear of having our wills drafted but not signed, not knowing how much life insurance we had, not knowing the password to his phone so I could call his family, etc., were often the things that pushed me right over the edge. All of that extra stress and pain could have easily been avoided with a few hours of organization and follow-through. I don't want anyone to suffer in the same way. Doing your will is a hassle. Collecting passwords is a pain in the ass. I know, I get it. But so is going to the dentist, changing the oil in your car, and getting an annual mammogram. And we managed to do that stuff anyway. So Get Your Shit Together was born. Out of scribbles in notebooks, hours and hours of making phone calls and tracking stuff down, there was an unbelievable amount of help from friends, not to mention numerous messy late nights, some very dark thoughts, and more than a handful of moments too unbearable to repeat. I mostly have my shit together. Now it's your turn. I want to help. In her case, the conversation they needed to have went beyond learning his wishes for end-of-life care. Certainly, the more practical details can be mind-boggling to navigate after a death. There are all sorts of resources online for collecting information like computer passwords, bank and investment accounts, life insurance, military records, etc., for survivors to find. To collect this information into one place, then communicate to your loved ones, where it is stored is another great service we can give them. Getting back to communicating our wishes for end-of-life care, we should mention a legally binding document in Massachusetts called the MOLST form, M-O-L-S-T. It stands for Medical Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. It needs to be discussed with and signed by a physician, nurse practitioner, or a physician's assistant. It covers CPR, intubation and ventilation, transferring to a hospital, artificial nutrition and hydration, and dialysis. This is the place to indicate if one wishes to be a DNR, do not resuscitate. There is a link to this document on the resources page as well, and I encourage you to look it over and discuss it with your healthcare team before you are in an emergency situation. It's always optimal to have this information ahead of time rather than scrambling in an emergency. Since we are speaking about this in a church in the context of spirituality, it's worthy of noting that one's spiritual beliefs can impact their end-of-life choices. I've seen people facing death that believe they will cease to exist after they die. In some cases, they may want every possible intervention tried in order to sustain life. And I have also seen people with a deeply held spiritual belief that their spirit will go on in some form after they die. In both cases, they may or may not go gentle into that good night, as in Dylan Thomas's famous poem. However, my experience of witnessing both leads me personally to believe that having some kind of faith, whatever that may be, helps one as they approach the precipice of mystery. It is certainly not, however, a prerequisite. Becoming familiar with this stage of life has enhanced my faith in something beyond this existence. It is oddly life-affirming to be around people that are near or at the moment of death. I've witnessed both deep suffering and great love, and it has informed how I live daily. I'd like to leave you with these words from the poet Ron Padgett. It's called The Death Deal. Ever since that moment when it occurred to me that I would die like everyone on earth, I struggled against this eventuality, but never thought of how I'd die exactly. Until around 30, I made a mental list. Hit by car, shot in head by random ricochet, crushed beneath boulder, victim of gas explosion, head banged hard in fall from ladder, vaporized in a plane crash, dwindling away with cancer, and so on. I tried to think of which I'd take if given the choice, and came up time and again with, "He died in his sleep." Now that I'm officially old, though deep inside not old officially or otherwise, I'm oddly almost cheered by the thought that I might find out in the not-too-distant future. Now for lunch.